You have written a tale that sent my blood into icy creeks.
HPPodcraft.com.
Such an audience needs something stronger than a pretty little love story. So why shouldn't I write of monsters?
When I placed my head on my pillow, I did not sleep, nor could I be said to think. My imagination, unbidden, possessed and guided me, gifting the successive images that arose in my mind with a vividness far beyond the usual bounds of reverie. I saw, with shut eyes but acute mental vision, I saw the pale student of unhallowed arts kneeling beside the thing he had put together. I saw the hideous phantasm of a man stretched out, and then, on the working of some powerful engine, show signs of life, and stir with an uneasy half-vital motion. Frightful must it be, for supremely frightful would be the effect of any human endeavor to mock the stupendous mechanism of the creator of the world. His success would terrify the artist. He would rush away from his odious handiwork, horror-stricken. He would hope that, left to itself, the slight spark of life which he had communicated would fade, that this thing which had received such imperfect animation would subside into dead matter, and he might sleep in the belief that the silence of the grave would quench forever the transient existence of the hideous corpse which he had looked upon as the cradle of life. He sleeps, but he is awakened. He opens his eyes. Behold, the horrid thing stands at his bedside, opening his curtains and looking on him with yellow, watery, but speculative eyes.
That is an excerpt from Mary Shelley's 1831 introduction to her novel Frankenstein, a novel which we are covering all month here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At HPPodcraft.com, I'm Chris Lackey.
And I am Chad Pfeiffer. Who was that reading Mary Shelley's introduction?
That is the most beautiful woman in the world, Rachel Lackey.
Excellent. And we'll also have Greg Johnson joining us once again to read in the second installment of our Frankencasting. That's two readers.
Too fast, too Frankenstein.
Exactly. That's the way we like to do in number two.
Rephrase that.
On this show. Anyway, at the end of last episode, we were speculating on Frankenstein's irresponsibility. That's where we kind of ended up. He created this monster, and then he just goes to bed. And then when the monster shows up to see him in bed, he runs away again. Now, that intro we heard was part of the 1831 edition of the book, as I said. And that was from the Standard Novels series. Mm-hmm. We have this intro where she talks about the contest that brought about this novel. And again, this is something we've discussed before, but if you're just tuning in, only for our Frankenstein episode.
Why would you do that?
I don't know why you would do it. Maybe you like Frankenstein, but you hate us, and you just want to...
That's fair.
I don't know. But here's the basics. Mary Shelley and her husband, the famous poet Percy Bysshe Shelley, were visiting Switzerland it was 1816, summer. They were neighbors with Lord Byron, where they were staying, and it was a rainy summer, and they were confined indoors a lot of the time, couldn't go out roaming in nature like they would have preferred.
Yep.
To pass the time, they were all reading ghost stories. Lord Byron proposed that each of them try to write their own ghost stories. There were four of them in this contest. That were the two Shelleys, Byron, and then Dr. Polidori, who wrote The Vampire, which we've covered before.
Love that story.
So they go off writing their own things. All of their stories are kind of neat, but they don't go anywhere. But Mary, she got terrible writer's block. She says in this intro that, you know, her whole life people have been pushing her to write, obviously because her parents were big literary superstars.
Yeah.
Her husband also had hoped that he could push her along in some kind of literary career. But in this case, she just couldn't come up with anything. She really well describes that feeling you get as a writer when you're sitting around just trying to come up with an idea. You know what I mean? Where you're just like, I'm gonna think hard enough till a cool idea pops in. She says, "I felt that blank incapability of invention, which is the greatest misery of authorship. When dull nothing replies to our anxious invocations. Have you thought of a story?" I was asked each morning. And each morning I was forced to reply with a mortifying negative. Mm-hmm. But then one night, she's sitting around listening to the guys have one of their sophisticated chats that they like to have. She says she's mostly silent during these conversations, but she listens in. And Byron and Shelley were talking about Darwin, galvanism, electricity. Can dead things be reanimated? So all of this was in her head when she went to bed that night, and then she has the dream that Rachel read for us up at the top.
Yep.
From there, this vision of a creator and the monster at the bedside, she knows she's got something, so she starts writing the story, first as a short subject, but her husband encouraged her to finish it up. she credits him in the foreword for pushing her along to get the thing done, although as she makes it very clear, the book is all her work.
Yes.
Not his writing. And people say, I cannot believe that a woman so young wrote this, but she had already eloped with a famous author, right? She'd had two children by this point. I mean, she was acquainted with the world. Life was a little different, I think, for folks in those days.
Yeah.
So she was fairly adult in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But that's the background of the contest. Now, in that excerpt that we heard, it seems like she explains what's happening with Victor when he goes to bed.
Right.
Says he would hope that, left to itself, the slight spark of life which he had communicated would fade. That this thing, which had received such imperfect animation, would subside into dead matter. So that's somewhat understandable. If I just leave it alone, it'll just die.
Yeah.
Kind of. But then the thing shows up at his bedside, and he's like, nope, I'm out of here. And he just leaves it to wander around up in his apartment, knowing that it's on its feet and grinning and doing stuff.
Feet get moving. As he leaves his monstrous creation alone at home, he wanders the streets with brain fever.
Mm-hmm.
And we've all been there, right?
Sure, I feel like I'm there all the time. No, but as Shelley says, he's simply just terrified by what he's done. It's
right.
To her, this is a moment of fear. And that causes this break from reality so that he's just wandering around the streets of Ingolstadt, like you said.
Oh, and also, fun fact, Ingolstadt is where the Illuminati was created in 1778.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
But this was the real Illuminati.
Yes.
There was an actual organization that was dedicated to Enlightenment ideals.
Yes.
It was against superstition and religion and government, and it was very pro-reason, pro-science. This is not the shady Illuminati that controls world affairs.
Or is it?
That all the punk rockers in my high school would always be referencing when I was a kid. Well, that's interesting to bring up about the Illuminati, because this book could be viewed as an argument against the values of the Enlightenment.
Yeah.
It was the quest for discovery and the pro-science attitudes of Victor that got him into this trouble.
Right. That's kind of anti-Enlightenment, because it says that there's things that you should not know, and the Enlightenment is like,
right,
hell no, you should know everything.
And tamper in God's domain.
You're allowed to. Have fun.
Well, I think that Ingolstadt was probably not a random choice. I think that that was... The fact that it was a seat of these Enlightenment ideals is probably exactly why she sent Victor there.
Victor is wandering around town with his brain fever and now it's morning and he doesn't want to go back to his house. So he's on a stroll and he sees his old bud, Henry. Now he finds out that Henry moved there to go to school as well. But since Victor has been so obsessed with his work, he didn't even know that Henry had come to move in the same town that he lived in.
Now, but hold on, though. That was you're doing some work for this novel. That's a very modern reading. Because remember last episode I talked about how there were ridiculous coincidences in this.
Oh, right.
It would make more sense the way you just explain it, that he had come to town and was studying and then Victor just wasn't seeing him because he was so absorbed in his work. But when Victor's out wandering around in this moment with his brain fever after having created the creature, a Swiss public coach approaches. This is Henry's first time here. He has just arrived for school. He steps out, he says, "My dear Frankenstein, how glad I am to see you. How fortunate that you should be here at the very moment of my alighting."
Oh.
So Victor ran into him just as he arrived.
Yeah, I thought he was on local transportation, like within Ingolstadt. But since it's a Swiss carriage, that means it came from Geneva. So he is just arriving into town.
This is the exact day that he arrived.
So Victor brings Henry back to his apartment. Again, I don't quite understand his thinking.
Right.
Because... either there's going to be a dead guy lying on the ground or there's going to be a live monster walking around. So
yeah, it's crazy. It's like, oh, I ran into my wife. I still have my girlfriend upstairs. I'll take her up for some tea and just see what happens. She might be in the shower. I don't know.
When they get back to Victor's, the monster is gone. Victor is ecstatically happy. The relief is just huge for him. And then he sort of breaks down at this point. And all this fatigue catches up with him. And the fact that he is probably just having a nervous breakdown throws him for this huge loop. He gets a nervous fever, is what they say. And Henry has to take care of him for months.
Henry came there for an education, but now he's got to put that on the back burner and be a nursemaid to his friend. And there's no sign of the monster. He doesn't come back. Wherever he went, he doesn't have plans to return.
Now, I know it's a little early in the show to do a tangent, but the monster isn't really a monster, at least at first. I mean, he's big and he's messed up looking, but that doesn't make him a monster.
I read this in your notes, and I looked up the definition of monster, and it is an imaginary creature that is typically large, ugly, and frightening.
But he's real, so he's not an imaginary creature.
But okay, so in that case. But my point is what you said, he's big and messed up looking, is what kind of defines him as a monster. It doesn't necessarily have to imply evil. Although that's how we use it frequently.
Well, anyway, there's a lot of ugly equals evil in this book, and that bugs me. And of course, all of this comes from Victor, who is a total a-hole. And we later get from the monster story that he was really very sweet when he was first created.
Right. But he's a monster in the eye of the beholder. And ugly equals evil happens in the real world all the time, which is why there's this dramatic tension in the book. Because in literature, it's what you would call the deformed hero archetype, where the hero's ugly. The Phantom of the Opera, Hop Frog by Poe, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, Beauty and the Beast.
Right.
It's an inversion where often in these stories, the hero is monstrous and then the villain is cute like you. It's unexpected.
But in the real world, you said in the real world, somebody's, you know, disfigured from a car accident. People don't point at him and go, monster.
Sure they do. What do you mean?
I mean, what?
Well, I mean, I think that people are discriminatory towards you if you're not attractive.
Yes, that's different from labeling somebody a monster.
So maybe it's not as overt as pointing and screaming. But, you know, if your car breaks down on the side of the road and you're ugly, good luck.
Here's my problem. I just don't like calling it the monster because I don't feel like that's really what it is. I feel like we should give it a name like Trevor or something.
Oh, okay, well, later in the story, then, on that point, the monster does say a couple of things. He frequently refers to Victor as his creator.
Right.
And even his father. He says, at length, the thought of you crossed my mind. I learned from your papers that you were my father, my creator. Yeah. And to whom could I apply with more fitness than to him who had given me life? So he self-identifies as a Frankenstein.
Right.
Kind of. And I think people call the creature that. Really, the reason they call him that is because of movie posters. They show Boris Karloff, and then it says Frankenstein, and that's where the association started. But
of course.
I think it's okay because that's what he thinks his name is, right? If Victor's his father, then he is a Frankenstein. But in terms of a first name, at one point he says, I ought to be thy Adam.
Yes.
But I am rather the fallen angel.
Yeah. And, you know, when I was a teenager, I got confused by that and thought that he actually named himself Adam.
Right.
I remember telling people that the monster's name was Adam and people were like, oh, wow, that's cool. Until somebody said, no, it's not. And I said, yes, it is. And then I went and looked it up and I was like, oh, shit, they're right.
He's saying that I should be your Adam, but rather I'm Lucifer.
Yeah.
So I'm just saying he doesn't name himself, but you could say, all right, it's Adam Frankenstein or Lucifer Frankenstein, which sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, it does.
Credible.
Sure.
That said, I'm cool if you just want to call him Trevor.
Yes, I do.
It's a beautiful name.
Trevor's great.
All right, well, Trevor it is.
This is one of the things about Victor that makes me think that he's like an immature jerk. At no point does he say, I made a guy named Trevor and he's running around somewhere. Right. Trevor is out of sight, out of mind. So. Yeah. Not my responsibility anymore.
Yeah.
Either he consciously is thinking about this or he's just doing something a crazy person would do. Or even a kid.
Or he just never gets around to telling you that his plan is if Trevor presents himself again, he'll go, I don't know who that guy is. a monster! Get everybody run! That, you know, that's another thing he could do. So he might have a plan in the back of his head.
No, something that made me think about this again, too, is this about shame? It's so important for Victor to hide what he's done that he's become this kind of wicked person that's brought this evil, as he sees it, into the world, and that he will just play stupid about it.
I think so. I think you've hit on exactly what it is. I mean, I think that according to Shelley's intent, it's initially about horror and fear and revulsion at this unnatural thing in defiance of the creator that he's conjured up. But it certainly turns into shame, especially once Trevor starts causing trouble.
Also, he's not a very good scientist because he doesn't really seem to think things through.
Right. Sure. I mean, why not reanimate something small first? It's the most obvious thing. I mean, even Herbert West did that.
Exactly.
The worst thing is maybe you end up with a sassy cat or something, but that's better than like an 8-foot murder machine as your first experiment. Frankenstein is like, I have a theory about how to build a better bridge. And what I want to do to test it is build the bridge and then have everybody drive across. You don't want to make a model or something first? Nah, we'll just see if a bunch of people die or not.
But he also, you know, he doesn't look at the data he's collected to get to the point that he is able to create life.
Yeah.
I mean, there must have been something that he learned from that, some medical procedure or something that could advance medicine or just human understanding and knowledge of death and life and how we work.
Sure, of course.
But he does this thing and he creates Trevor, but he doesn't try to find an upside. He just becomes a total weenie about it. And who knows what this thing is up to? You know, again, no responsibility.
Right.
He's just a selfish jerk.
Well, stories aren't really fun when the main characters start as wonderful people, or at least complete people. There has to be some kind of arc. There are lessons to be learned, and hopefully Frankenstein changes over the course of the book. We'll have to chart that progress. But made a great discovery, but then responded very rashly. And it's fear of what he's wrought that makes him crazy. And, you know, he's laid up and he's insensible for months with Henry nursing him. So he's actually incapable of even telling anybody about anything. He's just in a big hallucinatory spell for months.
And I just want to say, this isn't a diss on the book, all my criticisms here. I love this book, and I'm reading it and I'm feeling all these strong emotions towards Victor, and they're quite genuine.
As you should. And well, that's the fun of it, right?
Exactly.
I don't want to be staid and intellectual about this. Let's get into the guts of it. I thought this guy was an asshole. I like comments like that. That's great, you know? Now we're talking.
So when Victor feels better, Henry gives him a letter from Elizabeth. That gets us into chapter 6. Elizabeth says that she misses him, and the old family servant and friend, young lady Justine, has returned to the house since her mom died. She went to go take up her mom and she came back. Elizabeth wants Victor to come back home.
Now, Justine's story starts really sad. Her issue is that her mother just doesn't like her.
Oh.
She was growing up with a few siblings, and for some reason, her mother was like, that one I don't like. So Elizabeth's aunt provided for her education, and she set her up to live as a servant for the Frankensteins. Victor knew her most of his life. There was some political content here. It says, the Republican institutions of our country have produced simpler and happier manners than those which prevail in the great monarchies that surround it. Hence, there is less distinction between the several classes of its inhabitants and the lower orders. Being neither so poor nor so despised, their manners are more refined and moral. A servant in Geneva does not mean the same thing as a servant in France and England. Justine, thus received in our family, learned the duties of a servant, a condition which, in our fortunate country, does not include the idea of ignorance and a sacrifice of the dignity of a human being.
Wow.
And that's editorial. I feel like through her travels and their experiences here in Switzerland, she said, oh, wow, we kind of mistreat people in the UK. It's better when, even if you're a servant, that you still have access to education. It lifts everybody up, right? So it's the kind of sentiment you would expect from the daughter of a social theorist, you know, Godwin and a feminist mother. But eventually, Justine gets called back to her mother because all of her other siblings die.
Ugh.
And her mother starts thinking maybe her favoritism caused some curse to be brought down on her. The fact that she cast Justine away is why the children died. There's a terrible reality to this situation because that's when she calls her back. I need you with me now because the other ones are dead. And sometimes her mother is very apologetic and begging Justine for forgiveness. But more often than not, she gets cruel and she blames her for everything. And then eventually the mother dies and Justine is able to come back to them again happily because this is sort of her real family.
Yeah.
But again, it's one of these really interesting background stories that Shelley inserts here.
Yeah, there's a lot of these throughout the book where there's just these small tangent stories that they inform the larger story, but they're really almost short stories in and of themselves.
Yeah, this whole emotional thing with her mother and the push and the pull, I just thought that was so neat. And of course, it immediately fills you with sympathy for Justine.
Yeah.
So another thing I was thinking about, not to get too much of a tangent here, but Elizabeth recounts Justine's story in the letter.
Mm-hmm.
This is really Robert Walton, the sailor, writing a letter to his sister in which he recounts Victor's narrative, within which is this letter from Elizabeth.
Yeah.
And it's pretty... Now, maybe Victor had this letter and showed it to him, but that's doubtful.
Right.
Robert, right at the top of the novel, said he was a failed poet. So you might imagine that he himself is... Maybe he's making up all sorts of little details and things in this recounting.
Sure.
I mean, it's not like he had a tape recorder when Victor told his story.
No.
I even started to wonder at this moment if the whole thing is maybe all made up in Robert's imagination.
Wow.
He says he's super lonely out there on the ship. He wants a friend.
Yeah.
So maybe to pass the time, he uses his poet skills to crack out this whole story. He creates a friend and then has another story within it where the friend creates an enemy. You know, it's like, that's a lot of speculation. The important thing is that Elizabeth's letter ended with some local news that cracked me up. It says the pretty Miss Mansfield has already received the congratulatory visits on her approaching marriage. Her ugly sister, Manon, married this guy, the rich banker, last autumn. So even Elizabeth doesn't like the uglies in this book.
Oh, so mean.
Victor's glad to hear from Elizabeth, and he writes her back. Just the effort of doing that lays him up for another couple of weeks.
When he gets better, Victor also takes Henry to go see some of his professors. And when he sees the lab equipment, Victor kind of freaks out.
He can't stand talking about science.
And he decides to go back to Geneva. And then he has to wait to hear back from his dad about travel arrangements.
And there's some circumstances with the weather. Basically, it's going to be a while before he gets back.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of doing science stuff, he starts studying language with Henry, which really is just an opportunity for him to read Middle Eastern literature, something totally divorced from what he's spent the last 4 years right. working on. And they spend the whole winter, summer and winter, doing this and hanging out, and Victor's feeling better and happier, which, I mean, to your point, it's so crazy. All that time passes and you'd never just at some point throw out, I got to tell you about this guy, Trevor, I created.
I know.
I mean, at some point.
Yeah. Or just that, how does this not bother you? Like, if that happened to me, I could never sleep again. I would be a wreck forever.
Maybe. The mind recovers faster than you think.
Chapter 7, Victor gets a letter from his dad telling him that Victor's youngest brother, William, has been murdered. Victor is freaked out about it and very upset and leaves for Geneva right away.
Henry sees him off. What happened was William was out with Victor's other brother and ran off to hide somewhere and then was missing all night. At 5 a.m., they found him stretched out on the grass, strangled. I thought if you were doing a gloomy police procedural Netflix version of this, this is what you'd start with, him finding the body. Elizabeth blames herself for the death because she had let William wear this locket or miniature around his neck that has a picture of Victor's mother in it. And this was missing when they found the body. So they assume the theft of that miniature was the motive for the strangulation.
And by the time he gets to Geneva, it's night and the gates to Geneva have been shut, which is something I guess they did. They just closed up the city at night and you couldn't go in. So he had to wander around in the forest outside of town.
He gets to Geneva pretty quickly, but then he takes a couple of days before he can even go into the city. I think it's going to be such a shock to him because 6 years have passed since he was last home.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think 2 years have passed since he made the monster at this point. So
yeah.
That means discovering the secret of life and creating the creature took him 4 years.
Wow.
So you can say Frankenstein is a jerk all you want, but that's a little better than like getting a bachelor's in sociology, which is what most people could do in 4 years.
The guy is obviously crazy brilliant because he just did this thing, 18th century, which is even crazier. As he's out wandering, he goes around to where his brother was murdered and he thinks he sees Trevor in a flash of lightning, and he thinks Trevor is the one that killed his brother William.
It's this big romantic scene, the thunder and wind and rain, and boom, there's the creature just in a flash. And then the creature scales this perpendicular ascent on a hill and disappears, which is total superhero stuff.
There's a lot of that in this book.
Last we left him, he was a grinning fool, but now he's at full power and it's quickly demonstrated.
Yeah.
And the fact that he's lurking around here tells Victor, wait a minute, he must have done the crime. And also, he's super powerful, so this is going to be quite a bit to deal with.
The next day, when he returns home, he finds out that they think Justine, the servant that worked for them, killed William. She says she's innocent, but in her pocket, they found that picture of Caroline Frankenstein. Victor tells everyone she's innocent, but Justine was out wandering in the woods, acting sketchy as well. All circumstantial evidence, but she's the only suspect that they have. And Victor won't say anything about it because if he goes, oh, I think this monster that I made killed my brother. And he goes, if I told people that, they would think I'm crazy. So he says, because I think Victor is a coward. He could have easily told a partial truth, like Trevor was this guy that I knew and he was nuts and he was going after my family because he hated me and he wanted revenge. Or to make it more believable, he could have admitted to something bad, like say that, oh yeah, this guy Trevor was a grave robber that I paid to get bodies for me so I can do my medical research. This guy is a burn victim and he's really tall and he's super scary. And if you see him and he's totally evil, don't mess with him because he's a bad guy. He could have said so many, he could have done so many things, but he doesn't do anything.
Correct. And I agree with you that he absolutely should have tried something, even if it was stupid.
Yeah.
Well, let's go through this real quick. Before he arrives, Homer knows anything about Justine. After he's seen Trevor out there in the woods, he says, my first thought was to discover what I knew of the murderer and cause instant pursuit to be made. So he's saying, my first thought was I got to tell everybody about this.
Yeah.
But I paused. If I tell them the truth, it's going to sound crazy.
Yeah.
And I've recently had delirium, so people aren't going to believe me.
Yeah.
Besides, the strange nature of the animal would elude all pursuit, even if I were so far credited as to persuade my relatives to commence it. So they're not going to find him. What use would be of the pursuit? He can scale overhanging sides of Mont Saleve.
It doesn't matter.
These reflections determine me and I resolve to remain silent. Okay. So he's just worried that people think he's totally nuts. And then there's another huge coincidence. When he arrives home in the morning to see his father and brother and Elizabeth after 6 years, which is super emotionally overwhelming as it is, also with his brother being dead, which he just found out like in the night before that maybe this creature was responsible. This also happens to be the same day as Justine's trial. He gets there in the morning. The trial's happening in a couple hours. She's already arrested and it's happening. It's happening right now.
Yeah.
And it's the same moment he finds out that she's accused. So he's not getting a lot of time to construct an elaborate backstory like you had with a grave robber and that kind of thing.
Dude, it took me 10 seconds and nobody's life is on the line. You know, it's just something I threw up. You gave me a half hour to come up with like a plausible story.
Mm-hmm.
And all he has to do is
you're just bragging right now. Okay. You're just bragging.
All he has to do is put some doubt in these people's minds because she is the only suspect.
Okay. So on that point, his other reason is his faith in the justice system. The fact that there will be doubt in people's minds because she didn't do it. He says, I was firmly convinced in my own mind that Justine and indeed every human being was guiltless of this murder. I had no fear, therefore, that any circumstantial evidence could be brought forward strong enough to convict her. My tale was not one to announce publicly. Its astounding horror would be looked upon as madness.
Excuses.
People would think I was crazy if I said something, but it'll be okay because she's innocent. So the justice system will take care of that.
Oh, no.
And then before there's a verdict.
Yeah.
Justine complicates things more by confessing.
Yeah.
He can't prove that Trevor did this crime because he wasn't there when it happened.
No.
He doesn't have any evidence against him.
He saw him. That's eyewitness. He's like, look, I was out there. He was wandering around outside of the city. This guy, Trevor, who is a murderer and he's a horrible person.
Right. But anybody could have seen Victor out there, too. So just being in the place, isn't it?
Hold on here. If he said that to if he goes, hey, everybody. This guy, Trevor, grave robber guy who's a psychopath, he said he was going to kill everybody I loved. You know, this is my story. Right. He just said he's going to kill everybody I loved. I show up. My brother's dead. I show up and he's hanging outside of the city. Mm-hmm. We got to find this guy. I don't know where he is. I don't know where he's hiding out. Justine's gone. They're not going to even think about her anymore. It's not going to occur to them.
Or they're going
to
go, you're crazy. We have evidence. And
circumstantial. The whole reason she confesses is because she doesn't want to get excommunicated because they're threatening her with excommunication that she's going to go to hell.
Yeah. It's a coerced confession, which he finds out. So he still, at that point, has a chance. And then he goes out and he says to the magistrates, she's innocent. I know she's innocent. They go, why? And he's like, duh. And he doesn't say anything.
Yeah.
End of the day. It doesn't matter, but she's innocent and he should have tried something. I agree with you. In the context of the book, it seems like either he really believes these things and he's convinced himself that this is the right way to go forward, or he's just really good at making excuses.
That is exactly what it is. He is making excuses. He is a coward and a piece of shit and fuck him. Dude, this is like this nice girl that he knows, and he just sits on his hands and like makes up a bunch of excuses and doesn't take any responsibility. Like,
while she's hung, right? It says she perished on the scaffold as a murderess. So not only did she get killed in a terrible way, her memory is she's going to be remembered as a child murderer.
Yes.
Everything about it's terrible. If I recall correctly, I want to say this. When I read it as a teen, I think I cried. At the fact that Justine got killed, it really bothered me.
Yeah.
I wouldn't recall if this had happened, but I really don't recall questioning Victor's motives at that age. So I don't know. Maybe Shelley's keying into that undeveloped sense of responsibility the young person would have.
Yeah.
As a teenage author herself, because I mean, I did a lot of really irresponsible stuff when I was young. Obviously,
of course, not of this magnitude,
but I ran away from things that I probably should have fessed up to plenty of times. I mean, and Victor's like 23, 24 at this point.
Yeah.
So I think he just has a very, immature sense of responsibility in a very dramatic situation.
But she died.
I know.
This book is awesome. This isn't a criticism of the book. This is why I love the book, is because I am so into what is happening.
Yeah. And it gets you so ginned up about this kind of stuff. And that's why it's great. And it was such a, here you're reading this tragedy. It just wasn't what I expected when I dug into this.
Yeah.
It's really about Victor losing these people.
Yeah.
And that leads us into chapter 9, which is about his, how bad he feels.
Yeah. So Victor feels sad, blah, blah, blah. So Alphonse, hoping to cheer up Victor, that's his dad, takes everybody out to the family home at Bellerive. Once there, Victor wanders alone towards a beautiful valley. There's all this nature stuff and it cheers him up a bit.
Yeah, a bit. But he's pretty gloomy, drifting around on boats in the lake and staring into the water, etc.
There's a lot of description and talk here of the beauty and power of nature in a restorative fashion in these two chapters here. There are bits of nature, like the rain, that remind him of what he's done. So sometimes when it's sunny, he's happy. When it's rainy, he's sad. Mm-hmm. There was in the late 18th, 19th century, this idea in the Romantic movement that people should return to nature to experience true living. Not necessarily move out and live there, but go on walks and, get a nose full and that whole thing. And I think it's good, too, to go out in the woods and get a little nature. But mm-hmm. this romanticized idea of nature always kind of sticks in my craw a little bit.
Why?
Well, the only reason you can really enjoy nature is because we can control it. Mm-hmm. Raw nature is pretty terrifying and deadly. And I wonder if Shelley thinks so as well, because Trevor seems to be very comfortable in all these types of environments.
Right.
He really is at one with nature, and he's seen as this monster throughout.
Well, at least that's his superpower. I mean, sure. he doesn't need the things that humans need. We're much more frail than him. But I to your point, though, don't all animals control nature in order to live in it or enjoy it? Birds build nests, mammals burrow in the ground. We all have to kind of control it in some way in order to be able to stay away from predators and weather and things like that.
There is survival, which I think is what most animals do. I don't think there's much enjoying going on for an animal out in nature, especially if there's active predators and disease and all those things. Humans, sure. I think, can go and enjoy it because we're pretty protected in our civilization that we've built.
Or you learn how to cope with it and have tools. And
things. Sure.
But your idea is like, nature's pretty romantic, but don't go overboard. Is that what, you, is that what you're trying to say?
Pretty much, yeah.
Well, I also feel like these big natural scenes are there, the Arctic, the mountains, the mm-hmm. storm. Also in this romantic tradition of reflecting the emotions of the characters and the themes of the story.
Yeah. So chapter 10, his guild is still bugging him, so he decides to go to the summit and hoping that its pure beauty will restore him. And when he reaches the glacier at the top, he is comforted by the view, and he crosses to the opposite side of the glacier, and he sees a creature loping towards him at incredible speed.
Right. It's obviously the creature.
Trevor.
I love this approach, though. You know, he's appearing not in a flash of lightning or in some scary way. This is aggressive.
Yeah.
He's bounding towards Victor. It's a really aggressive way for him to enter the narrative. He is no longer going to be a device.
As he gets closer, he recognizes the grotesque shape of Trevor. And Victor says he threatens the monster.
Devil, I exclaimed. Do you dare approach me? And do you not fear the fierce vengeance of my arm wreaked on your miserable head? Be gone, vile insect! Or rather stay, that I may trample you to dust. And oh that I could, with the extinction of your miserable existence, restore those victims whom you have so diabolically murdered.
I expected this reception,
said the demon.
All men hate the wretched. How then must I be hated, who am miserable beyond all living things? Yet you, my creator, detest and spurn me, thy creature, to whom thou art bound by ties only dissoluble by the annihilation of one of us. You purpose to kill me. How dare you sport thus with life? Do your duty towards me, and I will do mine towards you and the rest of mankind. If you will comply with my conditions, I will leave them and you at peace. But if you refuse, I will glut the maw of death until it be satiated with the blood of your remaining friends.
Abhorred monster, fiend that thou art! The tortures of hell are too mild a vengeance for thy crimes. Wretched devil, you reproach me with your creation? Come on, then, that I may extinguish the spark which I so negligently bestowed. My rage was without bounds. I sprang on him, impelled by all the feelings which can arm one being against the existence of another. He easily eluded me.
Whatever. Whatever. You think Victor really was being all badass when an 8-foot-tall monster came up to him and he would get in its face and stuff? Victor was crapping his pants when Trevor showed up. And now he's trying to make himself sound tough.
Well, at least he said he easily eluded him, you know. I mean, he is. But, you know, I'll give that to you. I think maybe actually Victor probably told Robert the truth. You know, the monster showed up. I wet my pants. Robert was like, I can't write that to my sister. So I'll give him some cool dialogue and we'll just pretend that didn't happen.
So I think we're going to have to stop here. We're running out of time. And this is a good place to stop because we're going to get into Trevor's narrative, you know, his story of what happened to him. It's a big part of the book here.
And folks, if you don't like the name Trevor, send us your other names that you think would be appropriate for
sure.
The future. But they got to be nice names. I don't want any, you know, no Monstro or anything like that.
No, nothing like that.
So next week, we're going to listen to Frankenstein's story. I want to thank Greg Johnson for providing an excellent reading. And also, who do we have at the top again?
Rachel Lackey being our Mary Shelley. Thank you so much. That's all we have this week. I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hbpodcraft.com.
That wasn't the end at all. Would you like to hear what happened after that? I feel like telling it. The perfect night in mystery and horror.
The air itself is filled with monsters. I'm all ears.
HPPodcraft.com.